Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Our 30-minute program is designed for people learning English. We speak slowly, using a simple style and limited vocabulary. On the show today, we have reports from Brian Lynn and John Reynolds. Later, Jill Robbins brings us Ask a Teacher. And we close the show with an American story. We hear the second part of The Bride Comes to Yellow Sky by Stephen Crane. But first, take a bite, Sophia Begum tells her 18-month-old daughter, Romina Khatun. Romina is eating special food because she has not eaten enough healthy food. The condition is called malnutrition. Begum brings her daughter to a Save the Children Nutrition Center in Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh, once a week for an examination. There, the workers check Romina's weight and height. They measure around her upper arm. About 11% of children younger than 5 in the Rohingya refugee camps have some form of malnutrition. The rate is better than it was in 2017, when the figure was almost 20%. But it is still not acceptable. The United Nations Children's Agency, UNICEF, says children with severe acute malnutrition are at 10 times greater risk of dying than those with normal food intake. Plus, even moderate malnutrition can block normal growth. Joseph Senesi is a UNICEF nutrition expert. He explains why a good diet is important.
From pregnancy until the child is 2 years of age, that's 1,000 days. The child is not fed well, and the child's brain will not develop well.
Brain development affects the child's educational process and later job possibilities. More than 700,000 Rohingya Muslims have escaped to southern Bangladesh from neighboring Myanmar since August 2017. They fled a Burmese military campaign against them that UN investigators described as genocidal in aim. Myanmar denies the accusations. It says its operation was to answer attacks by Rohingya militants. The 1 million Rohingya in Cox's Bazar make up the largest refugee camp in the world. The refugees depend on humanitarian aid for basic needs. At 85 nutrition centers across the camps, workers examine children and, in case of severe malnutrition, give them special food full of protein, vitamins, and minerals. The food gives a lot of energy and other minerals that make corrections for the lack, says Mohammed Rahul Amin of Save the Children. Their families are given more of the food to take home for the children to eat between their weekly visits to the center. Zainab Bibi is the mother of an 11-month-old boy. She says, "Now we're getting help with nutrition, and my son is healthier, and he seems happier, too." There was major improvement within 3 weeks. Bibi says that is because he is getting the special food and she is getting lessons on nutrition and cleanliness. The lessons are for mothers and expecting mothers. Amin says, "We hope these lessons can prevent more children from ever becoming malnourished," There are fruit and vegetable stands in the camps, but many families cannot buy food because they do not have money. For many refugees, that means just rice and lentils to eat. Rice and lentils are not a balanced diet, Amin says. He adds that it is important to eat a mix of foods. For many refugees, that is not possible yet. Now, about one-third of the refugees are in families that get electronic cards with a monthly credit from UNICEF. They use the cards at food markets that sell fresh fruits and vegetables. The UN's World Food Program expects all of the families to have the cards by the end of the year.
San Francisco officials have approved a ban on the use of facial recognition technology by local law enforcement and agencies. The city's governing Board of Supervisors approved the ban this week. The board is expected to give final approval to the measure during a second vote next week. If given final approval, the ban would be the first of its kind passed by an American city. The measure bars the use of facial recognition by local police and all other city agencies. The ban is part of a bill that restricts surveillance technologies. The measure also orders San Francisco agencies to describe any current or future facial recognition activities. Use of facial recognition technology by government agencies across the U.S. has continually increased over the past 10 years. The machine learning methods that power the technology have also greatly improved in recent years. But the systems are not perfect. Privacy groups supporting the ban argue that facial recognition systems make too many mistakes and can violate personal rights. Several studies have shown the technology can have difficulties correctly guessing a person's race. Opponents of the ban included law enforcement agencies and some technology companies. They say the use of facial recognition systems should be permitted to help police identify and catch criminals. American technology company Microsoft is one company developing facial recognition. However, it has joined critics in calling for restrictions on use of the technology by government agencies. Microsoft President Brad Smith said last year he saw an urgent need to begin placing limits on the systems to avoid the kind of surveillance state described in George Orwell's book, 1984. Alvaro Bedoya heads the Center on Privacy and Technology at Georgetown University in Washington. He told the Associated Press he thinks facial recognition is one of those technologies that people get how creepy it is. Bedoya noted that San Francisco is considered the most technologically advanced city in America. A ban on facial recognition systems there could send a warning to other police agencies thinking of trying out the technology, he said. San Francisco police say they stopped testing face recognition technology in 2017. Spokesman David Stevenson said in a statement that police officials look forward to developing legislation that addresses the privacy concerns of technology while balancing the public safety concerns of our growing international city. I'm Brian Lynn.
When Victor Vescovo reached a depth of 10,928 meters in the Pacific Ocean's Mariana Trench, he took 15 minutes to look at what surrounded him. He had just reached what is believed to be the deepest point a human has ever gone in the ocean. He broke the record set by Oscar-winning director James Cameron. It was Cameron who suggested to Vescovo to stop and enjoy the moment. The deep-sea operation, filmed for part of an upcoming Discovery Channel documentary series, took almost 12 hours. I was stunned to discover when I did my research that of the five oceans, four had never actually had a visitation to their bottoms, Vescovo said. I thought it was about time that someone actually did that. Vescovo traveled down in a vehicle called the SDV Limiting Factor, a titanium craft outfitted with high-definition cameras. Patrick Leahy is with Triton Submarines, the company that made the SDV. He said such operations show why more exploration of the oceans is important for science. I think it's important for us human beings to study these areas, he said, noting how little is known about large parts of the ocean. The ocean is the life force of our planet, he added. Vescovo said that he believed he found many new species on the dive. He said the scientific group of the operation is excited and happy with what he brought to the surface for more examination. It's really great, he added. In addition to unusual animals, Vescovo saw something familiar, waste, especially plastic, in the deepest part of the water. Andy Sharpness leads Oceana, an environmental group. He called the discovery of waste materials there disturbing, but not surprising. I'm John Russell.
In today's Ask a Teacher, we answer a question from Valon in Rwanda. Please explain how to use Gona. Dear Valon, you probably hear native English speakers on television and in movies using reduced forms of words all the time. Examples are the terms Gona, Gada, Wana, Shuda, and Ada. In spoken English, we often put words together. In the process, we also leave out some letters and the vowel sounds change a little. So the expression going to becomes gonna. Here are a few examples of reduced forms informal and informal speech. Formal.
What are you going to do tonight? Do you want to see a movie?
Informal.
What you gonna do tonight? Want to see a movie?
Formal.
Sorry, but I've got to do my homework. You ought to do yours, too.
Informal.
Sorry, but I gotta do my homework. You oughta do yours, too.
Note that the informal examples are how many people normally speak. It would sound very formal and, as a result, strange to pronounce every sound of every word. This shortening of sounds happens in many languages. In English, you may not see the short forms in writing because writers are usually more careful to spell each word. But when a writer wants to show how a person is really speaking, these short forms can appear in books and, more commonly, in popular culture. Compare these examples from popular movies. The first is the reduced form of get out of there.
Hello?
Get out of there. They know. Get out.
Get out of there.
Don't talk to him. Get out of there.
Here are examples of it's going to blow.
Got a nuke coming in. It's going to blow in less than a minute.
But wait. But the plane, it's going to blow up, it's going to blow up.
Sometimes people have little time to tell others about their exact problem, so they use reduced form words. But people in everyday life also use reduced forms to seem friendly. It's fine to use terms like these when you are speaking with friends. It's better not to use them in English class or a formal situation like an office. Remember that you should not write the reduced forms, except in informal communication to friends or family. That's Ask a Teacher for this week. So, I've got to get out of here. I'm Jill Robbins.
From VOA Learning English, this is American Stories. Our story is called The Bride Comes to Yellow Sky. It was written by Stephen Crane. Today, we will hear the second and final part of the story.
Don't know whether there'll be a fight or not, answered one man firmly. But there'll be some shooting, some good shooting.
The young man who had warned them waved his hand.
Oh, there'll be a fight fast enough if anyone wants it. Anybody can get in a fight out there in the street. There's a fight just waiting.
The salesman seemed to be realizing the possibility of personal danger.
What did you say his name was?
He asked.
Scratchy Wilson,
voices answered together.
And will he kill anybody? What are you going to do? Does this happen often? Can he break in that door?
No, he can't break in that door, replied the saloon keeper. He's tried it 3 times. But when he comes, you better lie down on the floor, stranger. He's sure to shoot at the door, and a bullet may come through.
After that, the salesman watched the door steadily. The time had not yet come for him to drop to the floor, but he carefully moved near the wall.
Will he kill anybody?
He asked again. The men laughed without humor at the question.
He's here to shoot, and he's here for trouble. I don't see any good in experimenting with him.
But what do you do in a situation like this? What can you do?
A man answered.
Well, he and Jack Potter.
But the other men interrupted together.
Jack Potter's in San Antonio.
Well, who is he? What's he got to do with this?
Oh, he's the town policeman. He goes out and fights Scratchy when he starts acting this way.
A nervous, waiting silence was upon them. The salesman saw that the saloon keeper, without a sound, had taken a gun from a hiding place. Then he saw the man signal to him, so he moved across the room. "You better come with me behind this table."
"No thanks," said the salesman. "I'd rather be where I can get out the back door." At that, the saloon keeper made a kindly but forceful motion. The salesman obeyed and found himself seated on a box with his head below the level of the table. The saloon keeper sat comfortably upon a box nearby.
"You see," he whispered, "Scratchy Wilson is a wonder with a gun, a perfect wonder. And when he gets excited, everyone gets out of his path. He's a terror when he's drunk. When he's not drinking, he's all right. Wouldn't hurt anything. Nicest fella in town. But when he's drunk, be careful." There were periods of stillness. "I wish Jack Potter were back from San Antonio," said the saloon keeper. "He shot Wilson once, in the leg. He'd come in and take care of this thing." Soon, they heard from a distance the sound of a shot, followed by three wild screams. The men looked at each other. "Here he comes," they said.
A man in a red shirt turned a corner and walked into the middle of the main street of Yellow Sky. In each hand, the man held a long, heavy, blue-black gun. Often he screamed, and these cries rang through the seemingly deserted village. The scream sounded sharply over the roofs with a power that seemed to have no relation to the ordinary strength of a man's voice. These fierce cries rang against walls of silence. The man's face flamed in a hot anger born of whiskey. His eyes, rolling but watchful, hunted the still doorways and windows. He walked with the movement of a midnight cat. As the thoughts came to him, he roared threatening information. The long guns hung from his hands like feathers. They were moved with electric speed. The muscles of his neck straightened and sank as passion moved him. The only sounds were his terrible invitations to battle. The calm houses preserved their dignity at the passing of this small thing in the middle of the street. There was no offer of fight, no offer of fight. The man called to the sky. There were no answers. He screamed and shouted and waved his guns here and everywhere. Finally, the man was at the closed door of the saloon. He went to it and, beating upon it with his gun, demanded drink. The door remained closed. He picked up a bit of paper from the street and nailed it to the frame of the door with a knife. Then he turned his back upon the place and walked to the opposite side of the street. Turning quickly and easily, he fired the guns at the bit of paper. He missed it by half an inch. He cursed at himself and went away. Later, he comfortably shot out all the windows of the house of his best friend. Scratchy was playing with this town. It was a toy for him. But still, there was no offer of fight. The name of Jack Potter, his ancient enemy, entered his mind. He decided that it would be a good thing if he went to Potter's house and, by shooting at it, make him come out and fight. He moved in the direction of his desire, singing some sort of war song. When he arrived at it, Potter's house presented the same still front as had the other homes. Taking a good position, the man screamed an invitation to battle. But this house regarded him as a great stone god might have done. It gave no sign. After a little wait, the man screamed more invitations, mixing them with wonderful curses. After a while came the sight of a man working himself into deepest anger over the stillness of a house. He screamed at it. He shot again and again. He paused only for breath or to reload his guns. Potter and his bride walked rapidly. Sometimes they laughed together, quietly and a little foolishly.
"Next corner, dear," he said finally.
they put forth the efforts of a pair walking against a strong wind. Potter was ready to point the first appearance of the new home. Then, as they turned the corner, they came face to face with the man in the red shirt, who was feverishly loading a large gun. Immediately, the man dropped his empty gun to the ground and, like lightning, pulled out another. The second gun was aimed at Potter's chest. There was a silence. Potter couldn't open his mouth. Quickly, he loosened his arm from the woman's grasp and dropped the bag to the sand. As for the bride, her face had become the color of an old cloth. She was motionless. The two men faced each other at a distance of 9 feet. Behind the gun, Wilson smiled with a new and quiet cruelty.
"Tried to surprise me," he said. "Tried to surprise me."
His eyes grew more evil. As Potter made a slight movement, the man pushed his gun sharply forward.
"No, don't you do it, Jack Potter. Don't you move a finger toward a gun yet. Don't you move a muscle. The time has come for me to settle with you, and I'm going to do it my own way, slowly, with no interruption. So just listen to what I tell you."
Potter looked at his enemy. "I haven't got a gun with me, Scratchy," he said. "Honest, I haven't." He was stiffening and steadying. But at the back of his mind floated a picture of the beautiful car on the train. He thought of the glory of the wedding, the spirit of his new life.
"You know I fight when I have to fight, Scratchy Wilson. But I haven't got a gun with me. You have to do all the shooting yourself."
His enemy's face turned pale with anger. He stepped forward and whipped his gun back and forth before Potter's chest.
"Don't you tell me you haven't got a gun with you, you dog! Don't you tell me a lie like that! There isn't a man in Texas who ever saw you without a gun! Don't think I'm a kid!"
His eyes burned with anger and his breath came heavily.
"I don't think you're a kid," answered Potter. His feet had not moved an inch backward. "I think you're a complete fool. I tell you I haven't got a gun and I haven't. If you're going to shoot me, you better begin now. You'll never get a chance like this again."
So much enforced reasoning had weakened Wilson's anger. He was calmer.
"If you haven't got a gun, why haven't you got a gun?"
he asked.
"Been to church?"
"I haven't got a gun because I've just come from San Antonio with my wife. I'm married," said Potter. "And if I had thought there'd be a fool like you here when I brought my wife home, I would have had a gun, and don't you forget it."
"Married?"
said Scratchy, not at all understanding.
"Yes, married. I'm married," said Potter clearly. "Married?"
said Scratchy. Seemingly for the first time, he saw the pale, frightened woman at the other side.
"No!"
he said. He was like a creature allowed a glance at another world. He moved a pace backward, and his arm with the gun dropped to his side.
"Is this the lady?"
he asked.
"Yes, this is the lady," answered Potter.
There was another period of silence.
"Well," said Wilson at last, slowly, "I suppose we won't fight now."
"We won't if you say so, Scratchy. You know, I didn't make the trouble."
Potter lifted the bag.
"Well, I guess we won't fight, Jack," said Wilson.
He was looking at the ground.
"Married."
He was not a student of good manners. It was merely that in the presence of this foreign condition, he was a simple child of the wildlands. He picked up his fallen gun, and he went away. His feet made deep tracks in the heavy sand.
That's our show for today. But we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver.